Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, after the resignation of President Trump's national security advisor, questions about who in the White House knew what when. But despite the disarray in Washington, Trump supporters in Massachusetts say the president is delivering what he promised.
I think what we're looking at is really an extraordinary acceleration of a president who is a doer rather than a talker.
Also today, how to explain human consciousness.
When you put together teams, armies, of hundreds of millions of little robotic unconscious cells, somehow all that content of consciousness is accomplished. How is that possible?
Philosophy giant Daniel Dennett of Tufts University on how the human mind came to be. Plus, the UConn women make basketball history.
UConn makes it 100 consecutive wins.
All that coming up this hour on Radio Boston. First, this news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks, and we'll begin today with the latest upheaval in Washington following the resignation of President Donald Trump's national security advisor, Michael Flynn. Flynn stepped down after revelations that he misled Vice President Mike Pence and other top White House officials about his conversations with Russia's ambassador last December. It was a dramatic breach of protocol, especially because he apparently discussed sanctions against Russia before Trump became president. Today, the White House said that President Trump was informed weeks ago that Flynn had not told the truth about talking about his talks with the ambassador. In a minute, we'll hear from Trump supporters here in Massachusetts about what they think of the president's first 3 weeks in office. But first, from Washington, Matt Visor, Deputy Washington Bureau Chief of the Boston Globe. Matt, always good to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Anthony.
So Flynn is out. Lieutenant General Keith Kellogg has been named acting national security advisor in the interim. But this sounds like major disarray in the NSC right now. Bring us up to date on the latest fallout today from this event.
So we of course, last night had Mike Flynn's resignation. Today, there's been a lot of fallout with some Republicans in Congress calling for further investigations into the phone calls and things that led to his ouster. Sean Spicer, the White House press secretary, had a briefing earlier this afternoon where he made clear that the problem in the White House's view was not the phone call and these conversations that Mike Flynn had with the Russian ambassador to the United States in December, where sanctions are believed to have come up. The problem in the White House's view was not those calls and conversations. The problem was him lying and not claiming that he misremembered those calls,
right,
and talking to Mike Pence, the vice president. So they don't have a problem with his actions that, beforehand. They have a problem with what he did in trying to cover up some of those things.
Yeah,
a little bit striking.
Yeah, it is striking. And Mike, I was struck. I find this striking as well, that the White House said today that President Trump was informed weeks ago that Flynn had likely not told the truth about this.
That's right. At least sort of 17 days is sort of the time period where President Trump has known about this. Sean Spicer's claim is that they had to have some time to investigate and make sure that this was the case. For Democrats and others, that doesn't really add up. The president knew about this and really acted after public pressure came out. The Washington Post had a story a couple days ago that revealed that these conversations and that Mike Pence believed he had been lied to. Only after that did the pressure ratchet up on Mike Flynn to resign.
Mm. So you mentioned that some folks in Congress, I guess chiefly Democrats, are calling for a deeper investigation. I know that Elizabeth Warren sort of sent out a tweet storm today asking questions like, when did the White House know that Flynn lied? What other contacts with Russia occurred during the campaign? Who knew what? Who approved what? So where is Warren and perhaps other Democrats, where are they going with all of these questions? Where do they want to go with these questions?
They are calling for investigations, and they're trying to make this issue not just about Mike Flynn, but about a culture within the White House, sort of this mentality that allowed these relationships with Russia is one area that they're going. The idea of not telling the truth is another area they're going. They're also asking the question of who knew what when. Did President Trump know about this phone call and this talk of sanctions in December when it occurred? So there's a lot of questions that Democrats are raising. They, of course, don't control the House or the Senate, so they need Republicans to also be raising some alarms. And there's some early signs of some Republicans, being concerned. The issue of Russia sort of animates certain segments of the Republican Party. John McCain today has talked about the Trump administration's national security apparatus being in disarray. So there is some concern being voiced by Republicans. It's still a little bit early to tell whether that will lead to any sort of in-depth investigation.
Mm. I want to ask you about a tweet from President Trump this morning. He tweeted out, the real story here is, why are there so many illegal leaks coming out of Washington? Will these leaks be happening as I deal on North Korea, etc.? What's he referring to there, and what do you make of that tweet?
There are, in fact, a lot of leaks. It is sort of striking the way that we are seeing some decisions within the White House kind of discussed in real time. I mean, it's not rare for there to be some sort of infighting within an administration. It's not rare for people to talk about that. But what is rare is for some of these things to be coming out daily. There's different warring factions within Trump's administration, and so you're sort of seeing the results of that in public view. Some of the leaks that he's talking about, we've seen, the Washington Post had a transcript of a call that President Trump had with his counterpart in Australia. The Associated Press had a similar transcript of a call with the Mexican president. These are sort of things that are kept very tightly often. We don't see that. So those are rare, to be seeing those things unfold. But the tweet, is sort of a diversionary tactic, I think, from President Trump to get people talking about something different,
right,
than Mike Flynn, sort of as his own administration is a little bit in chaos.
Yeah, well, let me ask you one last question about that chaos, about the fallout over the resignation of Michael Flynn. Does this feel to you like a sort of regular, what's become a kind of regular bump in the road that seems to happen just about every day in the Trump administration? Or does this feel like something bigger, like a major pothole or sinkhole? Where does this go from here?
It does seem bigger. What we know about Donald Trump is he tends to not back down, and tends to not sort of shift gears that often. He did that a couple of times during his campaign. He had different campaign managers who would, be removed, and somebody new would come in. But this is extraordinary given the world events right now. Trump talked about ISIS a lot in the campaign trail. There's concerns about Russia and building a wall in Mexico, So to have a national security advisor leave 3.5 weeks into the administration is somewhat striking, given that President Trump also does not have his full team yet in place. There's still cabinet secretaries. His labor secretary in particular is being discussed this week and has met some resistance from Republican senators. So there's a lot going on right now that does make this feel like an unusual moment this early in the administration.
Extraordinary times indeed. That's Matt Visor, Deputy Washington Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe. Matt, as always, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
The resignation of National Security Advisor Michael Flynn is the latest setback for President Trump. It follows a controversial immigration order that sparked protests across the country and a decision by a federal appeals court to block it, at least temporarily. And it comes as Senate Democrats continue to slow down the approval of Trump's cabinet picks. But to his supporters, President Trump is fulfilling many of his campaign promises. And we want to check in with some of those folks right here in Massachusetts. Tom Mountain is chairman of the Newton Republican City Committee and a Trump supporter. I first met him at the Republican National Convention in Cleveland. And Tom, it's good to have you back on Radio Boston.
Thank you, Anthony. It's a pleasure.
And Janet Fogarty of Weymouth is a state committee woman for the Massachusetts Republican Party. She was a delegate for Trump. And Janet, welcome to you as well. It's good to have you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So first, I'll start with you, Tom Mountain. Your response to the news today of the resignation of National Security Advisor Michael Flynn and the apparent, what sounds to many people, the apparent disarray within the National Security Council. Does this raise concerns? What's your response?
No, not in the least. And I wouldn't even call it a setback, or I wouldn't even use the word disarray, mainly because whenever you put together such a huge team of cabinet officials and White House staff, inevitably some are just not going to work out. That can be the case in any type of government and certainly in business. And so this, while it was disappointing that General Flynn didn't work out, better to get it out of the way now rather than deal with these issues 6 months to a year later.
Right. Janet, what's your take?
Well, I think that it was the right thing to do, but I think that he's already put in place an interim National Security Advisor, and, you know, he's staying the course with how he has started his administration, and he's coming out fast and getting his agenda moving. So,
And I want to ask you more about that agenda and the pace with which he's getting that agenda moving, but let me ask you one more question about the Flynn case, and that is what we know so far is that Flynn did talk to the Russian ambassador about a number of things, including sanctions, before President Trump was inaugurated, and that's the problem. But I guess the question that remains is, did other members of the administration know about this? So I'll start with you, Janet. Are you all concerned, at all concerned, that this could go deeper, broader, be a bigger problem?
I'm not really concerned with that at this point. I think that, you know, there is obviously a lot of ongoing speculation and investigation or whatever into the implied interference from Russia into the election. And this is still kind of going on that path. And there will be a complete investigation, I'm sure. So
right.
I'm not concerned about it.
What about you, Tom?
No, there's no evidence that this is the a trend or even the beginning of a trend. I see it as really an isolated incident. And the president was very wise to take care of it immediately by accepting the resignation of General Flynn. And hopefully within a week, we will have put it behind us.
And
so,
also,
go ahead, Janet. Yeah.
I'd just like to add that we really don't know a lot at this point. You know, a lot of it is just speculation and by the media. And there's so much that we don't know. We don't know how those leaks came out.
Well, I agree with that. I think there is a lot that we don't know. And with at least a couple of investigations still ongoing in Congress, I think we're going to learn more. But that remains to be seen. Let me ask you both a very general question and answer it any way you want. How do you think President Trump is doing so far? Tom, is he meeting your expectations?
He's meeting them, and I wouldn't even say exceeding them, because Donald Trump is a man of his word. We knew and during the campaign that what he said he was going to do, he will do, and he is doing. So my expectations, our expectations, have certainly been met. And when I hear people surprised that he's suddenly putting into play what he said he was going to do, such as putting in play a 90-day waiting period for immigrants from seven countries and putting and halting the refugee program for 120 days. These are things that he talked about, elaborated on without going into specifics. I think what we're looking at is really an extraordinary acceleration of a president who is a doer rather than a talker. And what you're seeing now in the first 100 days, most presidents wouldn't accomplish in the first 100 days of what Donald Trump has done in the first few weeks.
Well, you brought up the issue of immigration. Mm-hmm. So let me ask you about that. I mean, of course, there have been protests. We've got the federal appeals court in San Francisco that didn't lift the stay. So for at least the time being, that order is blocked. Respond to concerns by some, including Democrats in Congress, that this order runs counter to long-held American values. Here's Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer speaking on CBS Face the Nation on Sunday.
It's just un-American and unconstitutional. A religious ban is just goes against the American grain. We believe in immigrants in this country, and we don't believe in a religious test. And finally, it hurts us economically. When immigrants don't come to this country, it hurts our job creation, our job growth.
So, Janet, I'll come to you. Respond to that idea that it's un-American to put an order like this in place.
Well, I totally disagree with what he said. The Constitution is for us, for the U.S. citizens. You know, refugees or foreign nationals that come into the country are not protected under our Constitution. I don't believe that it will affect adversely our economy. I think that, you know, perhaps there needs to be a modification to protect permanent residents and people that are on special visas here as well so that they can flow in and out of the country. But the president has a responsibility to protect us as a nation, and that's what this is about.
Mm. You know, Tom, as you know, there's a lot of concern here in Massachusetts, home to high-tech companies, universities, with students and employees from all around the world, including some of these countries that would be affected by this order. And there's concern over the order even from people like Republican Governor Charlie Baker. I mean, he's expressed concern about the order. Is he wrong about that?
Well, just to follow up with what Janet said pertaining to Chuck Schumer's comments, the senator really ought to read the Constitution that he's so fond of quoting, because it's within the president's parameters to halt or determine which refugees and which immigrants get into this country and for how long. So he's well within his rights for doing so. But specific to the issue at hand, the United States has traditionally welcomed immigrants that will benefit the economy and of the United States. Now, if that pertains to if we need a number of scientists, engineers, or what have you in the Boston area or in Silicon Valley, then certainly they will come through the HB1 visas or whatever visas will be procured in the near future. So it will be based on the immigration quotas will be based on the need for the American economy. The governor certainly can raise his concerns, but they're really not concerns that are, I think, that are valid right now, in that it's still a work in progress. Right now, the administration is concerned with getting a handle on the physical threats to the United States from potential terrorists sneaking in via the refugees and via the immigrants from those seven countries.
Let me ask you this. I mean, it does seem like at the very least, if there is some legitimate criticism here, and this has come from some Republicans who even support President Trump, that there was a problem at least with the rollout. Folks were caught unaware, surprised. Janet, do you think at least the rollout might have been handled a little differently?
Yes and no. I mean, he has made it clear that his rolling out anything that pertains to national security is not something that he's going to date stamp and, you know, let the potential enemy know exactly what we're doing, as was the case under Obama. So I don't think he needed to give like a timeline, like, okay, this is going to be implemented in a week or 2 weeks or whatever. But I do think that it would have been perhaps more beneficial to communicate it from the Oval Office in a national televised, you know, this is what's happening as we speak. This is being implemented. That might have, you know, perhaps smoothed it over a little bit.
On the other hand, it's been pointed out that there have been no terrorist attacks in the United States from anyone from these seven countries. So there is that to consider as well.
But these are countries like Somalia, like Iraq, like Syria, and the other four countries do not have the type of vetting program, the type of security apparatus to prevent right. those potential terrorists from coming into the United States. And so that being said, those countries have to be put on that watch list, not because necessarily a lot of terrorists have emanated from those countries, but in order to prevent any terrorist acts from happening in the United States. In other words, we're not going to wait for the next bombing, shooting, for us to say, well, we should have vetted those countries more particularly. Donald Trump is a man of action, and we're dealing with right now preventive issues.
I want to move on and ask you about his cabinet. The Senate has just approved former Goldman Sachs executive Steven Mnuchin to serve as the next Secretary of Treasury. He's now one of several exceedingly rich business folks in the cabinet. That includes two billionaires, Wilbur Ross, who we picked as Commerce Secretary, and Betsy DeVos to head the Department of Education. The cabinet is mostly male, mostly white, very pro-business. Janet, does that square with his populist campaign message to drain the swamp?
Yes, I believe it does. I think it squares very nicely.
Tell me why.
Well, because they are not typical establishment type of appointments that you would expect. These are very experienced individuals in the area that they're being appointed, such as Mnuchin. And I think that, you know, especially being head of the Treasury, to have someone that has been extremely successful in the financial area, I don't see any issue with that at all. I think that that's going to be a good appointment.
Mm. Tom Mountain, same question to you.
Yes, these people are billionaires like Donald Trump was. And I wouldn't be surprised if most of them do not take a salary while they're in office. Now, bear in mind, these people have definitely taken a pay cut to do this, but they're true public servants in the altruistic sense of the word. They really are. And they're here to serve, and they're here to serve because the president asked them to. They're in very interesting positions as cabinet secretaries where they would be able to enrich themselves now and in the future through lobbying, et cetera, but they won't need to do that. They're not going to do that because money is not an object for them. They don't care about it. They're just here to serve the American public. And after 4 to 8 years, then they'll retire or go back to their prior business life.
Well, I mean, Trump is a businessman, of course. A lot of his supporters like you liked that about him. And he seems comfortable surrounding himself with like-minded business people. But is there reason at all for concern that his administration might lack political experience, the kind of experience that might have handled the rollout of the executive order a little differently, the kind of experience that might have prevented a Michael Flynn from getting tripped up in the way that he did? What do you think? Are we undervaluing political experience, Janet?
No, I don't think so at all. He's surrounded by political experience. And I think this is what we elected. We wanted someone that was an outsider, someone that was a proven successful business person that will run the country, run government like a business. So I think that that's not an issue at all. He is appointing all the best of the best, such as like Mattis, who obviously has, you know,
Secretary of Defense, former General John
right.
Mattis, right?
Yeah. Right. So
Tom Mountain, you
best.
Agree with that?
Yes, yeah, certainly. But you know, bear in mind, this is the first time in the history of the United States that we've elected a president who has not come directly from government, or who has never served in government, or hasn't come from the ranks of the generals in the military. So this is really an extraordinary time in that. What you're seeing is President Trump is bringing in a lot of people who are virtually unknown to the American public because they're not a part. They weren't a part of either the Republican establishment in Washington. They weren't a part of the political scene. So inevitably, what you're going to see is these people are not polished politicians. They're not politicians at all. The administration is not. So there'll be missteps. There'll be mishaps. But so far, they've been pretty minor, with maybe the exception of General Flynn. But that really is not a major thing. Resignations will inevitably happen.
I want to ask you both, as loyal supporters of Donald Trump, I have to assume that you will also hold him to a high standard, and that you want him to deliver on his promises going forward. So, Janet, I'll start with you. What's the test for him? In other words, is there a threshold issue that might cause you to stop supporting him? I mean, that is, I want him to accomplish X, Y, and Z, and if he doesn't, I'm going to be disappointed.
Well, where he has already started with his executive orders is it's faster than I had expected, and I'm thrilled about that. So as long as he does what he campaigned on, and I believe he will, if he were to get caught up in the political gamesmanship and succumb to that, then that would be almost becoming more of the same of what we tried to get rid of.
That would be disappointing to you. What about you, Tom? Yeah, what about you, Tom?
Well, my two big yardsticks, one, the wall, and almost all of his supporters trumpeted the wall. And so I think that is going to happen, and it will be a great celebration when it does happen. There'll be roadblocks along the way, but inevitably that will happen. And the other thing, just coming from the, shall we say, the assignment that I had during the campaign, I was in charge of Jewish outreach for Eastern New England, primarily Massachusetts and New Hampshire. So I would like to see the American Embassy finally move to Jerusalem. And I think that that's going to happen very soon. So when those two yardsticks are reached, and I will be, I am ecstatic now that Donald Trump is president, but I will pop the champagne, especially for each of those events when it happens.
And also to add to that, I just will hope that people will take a pause, take a step back, give him a chance. He is our president. He's the president for all of us. And these protests and this outbursts and everything, we hopefully will subside. We really need to get a handle back on civility.
All right. Well, that's Janet Fogarty of Weymouth. She's a state committee woman for the Massachusetts Republican Party. She was a delegate for Donald Trump. And Tom Mountain, chairman of the Newton Republican City Committee. Tom, Janet, thank you both for coming in. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank
it's great
you,
to be here.
And stay with us. Coming up, Tufts philosopher Daniel Dennett with some big ideas about the evolution of the human mind. Stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Daniel Dennett is one of the most celebrated philosophers of our time, a prolific writer, thinker, and speaker, and a giant in the field of cognitive science and philosophy. He's the author of more than a dozen books, including Consciousness Explained, which argued that the human brain is a type of computer, and Darwin's Dangerous Idea, which aimed to explain all of human existence not through religion, but through natural selection. Now Dennett has a new book with the wonderfully provocative title, From Bacteria to Bach and Back, The Evolution of the Human Mind. Daniel Dennett is a professor of philosophy at Tufts University, and he joins me now in the studio. Professor Dennett, welcome back to Radio Boston. It's great to meet you, and thank you for coming in.
I'm delighted to be here, Anthony.
The very first questions on the first page of your book are these. How come there are minds, and how is it possible for minds to ask and answer that question? And I love that as a starting point, and I'd love to just sort of put that out there and get you to, I mean, I know this, a book follows those questions, but answer that, take a shot at that question or those questions.
The reason why the question is so difficult is because we have to start with the beginning of life on the planet. Yeah. And what we have to realize is that even the very first living things, things like bacteria, were tremendously complex, and it was as if they had minds. They were very competent at staying alive and reproducing. And what Darwin showed, and has been confirmed 100 times, 1,000 times over ever since, is that a completely natural, material, purposeless, godless process of natural selection has generated over billions of years ever increasingly complex minds, brains, and we human beings are the possessors of the most amazing minds of all. In fact, our minds are unique in many different ways, but that doesn't make them supernatural. Hmm. They are natural parts of the natural world, and the hard part is explaining how that can possibly be so.
How that could possibly be so, thinking about the way life evolves over the millennia from these little bacteria and little globs of life, and then suddenly we have these amazing things on our heads that arguably give us consciousness, although I know this is one of the big questions that you get into.
Well, consciousness is certainly the highlight of the human mind,
right?
But it's not quite so magical and mysterious as a lot of people think. For a lot of people, if you don't mean something almost supernatural by consciousness, then you're not talking about consciousness. Hmm. And for 50 years, I've been trying to argue, no, it's wonderful. It's just the greatest gee whiz marvel of all, but it's not supernatural and it's not immaterial. We can explain it all in terms of what's going on in brains and the things out in the world that those brains are responding to.
Well, I want to get to that. I want to sort of ask a kind of a silly question, because as I told you before we started recording, this has been by my bed for the last couple of nights, and I've been really enjoying getting into this book. But I was staring at my cat, you know, and I'm thinking, so that's my cat. He's got a little brain. This is me. I've got a big brain. I'm conscious of that. I know that my cat isn't thinking the way that I'm thinking. You know, he's sort of responding to what's warm and where the food is and all that. But I got to believe that apart from our pure biology, there's something that separates us, and that's my ability to basically describe what I just described, which is a way of saying consciousness, isn't it?
Well, that's what separates you from your cat, but I wouldn't call that consciousness. The cat is sentient. The cat has pain and loves warmth and has pretty good eyesight and very good hearing and very good sense of smell, and all of these contribute to the cat's getting through the day quite gracefully,
right,
and successfully. You've got that too, and so does every living thing on the planet have that basic set of competences, some much more than others. What distinguishes your mind from the cat's mind is that the cat's got, you might say, a bare brain, doesn't have any thinking tools. Mm-hmm. You, however, have been picking up thinking tools since you were born.
Now, you write about this. Explain what you mean by thinking tools, because I love this concept that you describe.
Well, there's tools like hammers and telescopes and screwdrivers, which are concrete material objects.
Right.
But then there's tools that are ways of doing things, like long division or finding the average or speaking.
Yeah.
And every word in your vocabulary is a thinking tool. Where do they come from? Who invented them? Nobody. That is, there are tools that have inventors, that have authors. There are words that have been coined. But those are a tiny fraction of the very latest tools. And how were they possible? How could we have intelligent designers, human beings, that made wonderful things like computers and telescopes and sonnets and symphonies and all the rest? The answer is there's a second evolutionary process just as natural as Darwinian natural selection of genes, and that's natural selection of cultural items, of thinking tools, really.
Thinking tools, huh.
And they didn't start out being tools. They just were things that could replicate sort of the way viruses do.
Yeah. So in other words, we acquire and evolve thinking tools because it's the way that we essentially stay alive, very much like animals will develop wings or abilities to walk and opposable thumbs and all these kinds of things.
Birds make nests.
Yeah.
Spiders weave webs.
So
and we weave webs of words.
Yeah.
And without them, we'd be pretty helpless. And we acquire our raw materials for this not through our genes.
Huh.
We acquire them through our upbringing and through just being alive and out in the world and looking at things. We pick up thousands of well-designed thinking tools, and we install them like apps in our necktop.
It's a great image. But what is this? Doesn't this raise big questions about free will? I mean, if we're thinking about sort of higher intellectual abilities as being developed like, muscles on our body, aren't we in a way saying that we're not really using our brains to express free will in the way that we think we are?
The problem with the concept of free will is that there are two quite different notions which are often run together and really, I've argued, have very little to do with each other. One of them is the idea that we are somehow, when we make a decision, we're physically cut off from any earlier sources of causation. That's the idea that our free will must be undetermined by the fabric of causation of the past.
Right.
That's baloney. First of all, if it were true, you couldn't be responsible for it. It would be like rolling the dice. It would be like a quantum effect roulette wheel. You couldn't be responsible for anything you do because it wouldn't be the result of your thinking, which in turn was the result of your learning and your discussions with other people and your acculturation, your moral upbringing, all the rest. We don't want to be cut off from that. Mm-hmm. We want that to play a very significant role in turning us into responsible agents. So the idea of indeterministic free will is a several thousand-year-old mistake. But there is a very good notion of free will, often called compatibilist, which says free will is compatible with determinism or indeterminism. Physics has nothing to do with it. Free will is a very special suite of competences that most normal human beings have. No bears or monkeys or donkeys have it.
Mm-hmm.
Small children don't have it. People who are deranged or have pathological neural conditions very often don't have it. It's the capacity to think ahead, to be moved by reasons, to be capable of self-control, and to have, you might say, moral imagination. And that is a very real phenomenon. It has evolved culturally and genetically. It is something that some people don't have it, and sometimes it's not their fault. They've been afflicted in some way. Each of us who does have it has a certain responsibility to keep ourselves in that state.
I want to ask you about something else. You're among the leading thinkers on atheism, and you wrote the book Breaking the Spell, Religion as a Natural Phenomenon, in 2006. And you've been called a Darwinian fundamentalist for your views on the divine. Is there space for divine design in your explanation of the mind?
Absolutely not. In Darwin's Dangerous Idea, I introduced a pair of terms, skyhook and crane. Cranes are not miraculous. Skyhooks of the kind that you just hang in the sky and you can lift things.
They don't work so well.
That's a fantasy. That's magic. It doesn't happen. And ever since Darwin, the big question has been, can we get all the way to us, all the way to Shakespeare and Bach and Jane Austen and wonderfulness, can we get all the way there from bacteria?
Yeah.
And the natural answer is yes, and it's all done with cranes. Hmm. No skyhooks. There's no role for any skyhooks. They're not needed.
Great image there. From bacteria to Bach and back. So what's the concern about? I mean, I'm assuming it's a concern. I mean, can we go back from Bach?
We're now living in the age of intelligent design. A lot of intelligent designers out there, artists and scientists and technicians and people that make computers and games and political parties and all of that. So we unquestionably, there are now plenty of intelligent designers, human beings. The age of intelligent design is only a few thousand years old. Go back 10,000 years to the birth of agriculture, and that's got most of it. There's a little, of course, everything starts gradually. We're now entering the age of post-intelligent design. Because what we've learned as intelligent designers is that evolution is cleverer than we are at some things. So we're now turning to making technologies that are fundamentally Darwinian, or they're versions of natural selection. And this is things like deep learning, the program that won, beat the world's Go champion, AlphaGo, the other day. These are technologies which do their work the way natural selection does. Mindlessly, without consciousness, without forethought, they grind out better and better and better and better and better designs. And now we have, in effect, black boxes that a scientist can use where they put in the data, they push the button, out comes an answer. They know it's a good answer. They have no idea how it got there. This is black box science. This is returning to our Darwinian roots.
Interesting.
And giving up on the idea of comprehension.
Well, let me, final question, because we're up against the clock here, but speaking of artificial intelligence, does that mean artificial intelligence will evolve like the human brain and surpass the human brain?
Oh, artificial intelligence has already surpassed the human brain in many obvious ways.
Right. I mean in the big sort of cosmic way.
Yeah. I think, although that's possible in principle, and some people make a great deal of this, and they imagine a coming age where we have a super intelligence that will simply leave us in the dirt. I don't think it's going to happen. I think it's much, much harder and more expensive than people realize. And we're better off using tools, not trying to make colleagues. There are plenty of colleagues around. And so we don't need conscious robots. We need unconscious robots that will do slave labor, and it won't be a bad thing for them to do it because they won't have feelings. They won't have rights. You can take them apart. You can throw them away.
And we can control them.
And we can control them.
Well, Daniel Dennett, what a pleasure talking to you. He's the professor of philosophy and co-director of the Center for Cognitive Studies at Tufts University. His new book is From Bacteria to Bach and Back, The Evolution of the Human Mind. Professor Dennett, thanks so much for coming in to talk to us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. I enjoyed talking with you.
And stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. This afternoon, the state's highest court heard arguments in a dispute between a needle exchange program in Hyannis and the town that's hoping to end it. At issue is the Aid Support Group of Cape Cod's distribution of free, clean needles and syringes. Both sides have cited public health concerns. WBUR reporter Deborah Becker was in the courtroom today and joins us. Hi, Deb.
Hello there, Anthony.
So lay out the issues here. What's the issue for the town?
Well, officials in Barnstable, which oversees Hyannis, say that the social service organization, Aid Support Group of Cape Cod, cannot distribute needles. One problem that they've described is the large number of discarded and uncapped needles littered around Hyannis, and they say that poses a public health threat. The town's arguing that it's illegal for a private organization to distribute the needles. They say that when the state legislature in 2006 decriminalized possession of needles and syringes, it only allowed needles to be purchased at pharmacies by anybody over the age of 18 or to be distributed by social service programs that are run by the State Department of Public Health. So the lawyers for Barnstable argued today that needles can only be distributed in those two manners and private groups cannot give them out. Supreme Judicial Court Justice Margot Botsford questioned Barnstable attorney Charles McLaughlin and said, if someone gave someone else a needle, does the law say that that person would be doing something illegal? Let's listen.
In express language, it doesn't.
So how is he supposed to know that he's violated anything?
Because the legislature has expressed itself in saying with specificity that there are two methods of distribution.
So, Anthony, that was the thrust of the town's argument today, that this needle distribution program, which has been operating for about 2.5 years in Hyannis, is operating illegally.
All right, operating illegally. And what is the Aid Support Group saying in support of its case?
So they say they're helping to fight the public health crisis, especially of the opioid epidemic, mainly by preventing other deadly diseases associated with intravenous drug use, such as hepatitis C and HIV. Here is attorney Ben Klein representing the Aid Support Group of Cape Cod.
There is no prohibition in the law, either in Chapter 111, Section 215, or 94C, Section 27, on a group such as Aid Support Group of Cape Cod, a private entity, distributing needles.
And we should say, Anthony, that Aid Support Group of Cape Cod says on average it distributes needles to about 12 people a day. They've also been in talks with the town for a while, and they have someone clean the area near their program every day, and they've put in disposal boxes as well.
I see. Interesting to note, Deb, that this is all playing out against the backdrop of the state's opioid epidemic.
That's right.
Right.
And Cape Cod, just like Massachusetts on the whole, is hard hit by this epidemic and by fatal overdoses. And we should say, along with needles, the program distributes the overdose reversal drug known as Narcan. Barnstable officials, though, Anthony, say they're not arguing against the work of this group and what they're doing to help with a public health problem, but they say they have to consider the health of all Barnstable and Hyannis residents by making sure that someone is not carelessly discarding needles that could harm someone else, perhaps spreading the very infectious diseases that the program is trying to prevent.
All right. And finally, in the few seconds that remain, what is the court need to decide here? What's the sort of threshold issue?
Well, this essentially has been going on for about a year and a half. It started when Barnstable officials issued a cease and desist order against this program in the fall of 2015. According to reports in the Cape Cod Times, police then said they had obtained dozens of needles from this program and there was little oversight. A lower court judge, though, issued an injunction against that cease and desist order, and the group's been operating under that ever since. So the SJC essentially is being asked to determine if private groups like the AIDS Support Group of Cape Cod can distribute needles like this. And justices did wonder aloud today if this is something that the legislature may eventually have to revisit.
All right. WBUR's Deborah Becker. Deb, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Let's talk now about a truly amazing sports milestone just to the south of us in the fair state of Connecticut.
The UConn Huskies have beaten South Carolina. UConn makes it 100 consecutive wins.
That's right. The University of Connecticut women's basketball team made history last night. They beat South Carolina 66-55 and notched their 100th straight win. Joining us to talk about the amazing game and this amazing team are Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. Hey, Bill.
Hello, Anthony.
Also with us is WBUR sports and society reporter Shira Springer, who, Shira, I gather you grew up sort of down the street or right next door to the UConn
Huskies. Yeah, pretty much a stone's throw. I went to the UConn Dairy Barn a lot for ice cream.
All right, well, let me start with you then. Quite a milestone. I mean, we sort of take it for granted. Yeah, they won again, but 100 wins.
Yeah, I mean, this is just impressive. And what I love about it is I think UConn is one of these rare programs that sort of defies gender. It's gender transcendent in some ways. You know, people don't say, oh, this is, you know, an amazing accomplishment for a women's basketball team. This is an amazing accomplishment for a college basketball team, period. And Gina Auriemma, their coach, is an amazing coach, period. It's not about gender when you talk about the UConn women's basketball team, or at least it doesn't need to be. And to that point, my parents were visiting last night, and my dad was like, you know, come get me when the game is on. And I'm like, which game? And he's like, UConn,
of
course.
You have to ask that question?
Exactly. I mean, he was just incredulous when he looked at me like, how could you not know that the big game tonight was UConn?
Wow. So, Bill, let me come to you. I know you've been down there. You've done stories about this team. What's your take on how they got here?
Well, I think, you know, that the way they got there is partly because Gino Auriemma is an exceptional recruiter, and partly because he's an exceptional coach. And many years ago, when UConn was only extremely good and not otherworldly, I asked Gino Auriemma, what advice would you give to a coach trying to build a great women's team somewhere else? And he said, simple, recruit Rebecca Lobo. But the thing is, since Rebecca Lobo, you've had this ongoing list of wonderful, great players. And I think last night's game was particularly informative, because they got a young woman on the team this year named Katie Lou Samuelson, wonderful, talented, great big, you know, fast, clever player. Something like 10 of the first 15 games of the season, she was the leading scorer. Last night, she had a bad night. She was very well defended by very tall, strong defenders from South Carolina, but she had a bad night. She couldn't shoot, couldn't find the ocean with a rock. No problem. Gabby Williams comes up, 26 points, 14 rebounds, greatest game of her career. That's what they do. They do what great teams do. The difference is they do it every night.
Every single
night. That's the exceptional thing.
I was going to say, though, the interesting thing about this team in particular, Bill mentions the recruiting, but this was supposed to actually be a rebuilding year.
It was supposed to be a bad year.
Exactly. They lost three big stars. They won last April. They won their fourth consecutive NCAA title. And from that team, they lost three major stars, Brianna Stewart, Mariah Jefferson, and Morgan Tuck. And this, like you know, I was saying, it's supposed to be rebuilding. They weren't supposed to continue the streak. And so in that way, this is all the more amazing because, yes, they have good recruiting. And, yes, Gina Auriemma is a great coach on the Belichick level. But they also do things, I think, in practice and in how they train that perpetuate this success. You know, the players often say that the practices are tougher than the opponents that they face.
I feel like we need to hear Gino Auriemma's voice in this segment that we're doing, the UConn coach. So here she is talking last night about last night's team effort.
Tonight was, they carried the torch across the finish line, so to speak, to 100. It was a relay. They took the last baton and they crossed it.
Of course, Gino Auriemma, I referred to she. Of course, he misspoke there. No other basketball team in the NCAA, male or female, has neared the 100 mark. The UCLA men's team under John Wooden won 88 games in a row. And here's a fact. The last time this team lost, November 17th, 2014.
And that was overtime.
It's ridiculous.
They could have won that game.
2014.
I mean, it's just astonishing when you think about this and so what they've built there.
Yeah. So, Cher, growing up with a team like this in your backyard, I mean, what was that like?
I mean, it's fantastic because what's great is you get to see everybody. The whole state embraces this team. And what I loved about watching the game last night was you had a packed arena and you had male college students with their shirts off, chests painted just like they would have been for the men's game. And I love that intensity, that enthusiasm, that passion. Students were waiting for 6 hours to get front row seats to last night's game. It's great for women's basketball. It's great for college basketball.
And great for sports in general. Shira Springer, WBUR Sports and Society reporter, and Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game, which airs Saturday at 7 a.m. and again at 7 p.m. And thank you both very much.
Thank you, Anthony.
Thanks
That's
for
it for
me.
Today. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.